It is Britain's Radical History. Who were the Levens? We've got Dermot Smith. To talk to us for about...
How long would you think?
20, maybe 25. Then we'll probably be shut up.
I'm bringing him in too much to introduction. So. Right, and then we'll have reports back from Newark, KALO, the UCU conference, things like that. So I'll hand over to Dermot.
Thank you. Right, the title I've been given, saw in the paper anyway, was Who Were the Levellers? I'm actually going to talk about the levellers and the diggers as well. Partly because the digger experience followed very closely and sort of grew out of the leveller experience. And the second reason is that I'm actually doing this talk on four other occasions. And the title of those meetings mentions both. So it's, you can get both. So the levellers and the digger experience took place within the English Civil War period. Now, it's often referred to as the Civil War, full stop, but in fact it ran from dates usually given 1640 to 1660. That is accepted by academic historians as a civil war. You could, you know, could hardly avoid avoid that. But within that period, there was also a revolution, the English Revolution. That isn't actually accepted by a lot of I've got right-wing historians. But it's important to our tradition, our socialist and Marxist tradition. So I'm going to summarise very briefly the events of that 20-year period, for the reason that political events of any sort, dramatic or otherwise, don't actually just come out of a clear blue sky. breakdown in society, system crisis, you know, systemic crisis, when the rulers are just unable to carry on ruling society in the old way, is what allows all these kinds of political events to come to the fore. So to summarise that 20-year period, there were really three separate civil wars. I'm going to say virtually nothing about those between 1642 and 1651, other skirmishes before and after that. Estimates up to 250,000 people died as a result of the Civil War, the Civil Wars. Of those, about 80,000 died actually in the battles. So this wasn't, you know, this was a serious war with tremendous carnage and brutality on both sides. In that period, King of the time, King Charles I, was held under arrest, was arrested and held on and off in different parts of the country on different occasions from 1646 onwards. December 1648, there was what in modern terminology we would call a military coup, when the parliamentary forces went into Parliament and arrested most of the MPs who were pro-royalist, and Charles again himself arrested. Then the revolution, I think you could say, runs from December 1648 to 1649, during which the King was executed, England was declared a Commonwealth by Cromwell, who was the head of the army, the new model army, and ruled, again using modern terminology, ruled as a military dictator, basically. There was the pretense of Parliament actually being supreme politically for several years up until 1653. After that, even that was shunted aside, and Cromwell declared himself a Lord Protectorate, Lord Protector of a Protectorate, until his death in late 1658. So that's just to remind people of the, you know, the level, the dramatic level of events in that period. But I think more importantly, I've got to set the context, what was going on, if you like, under the surface at the time. First of all, there was an ongoing land grab, expropriation and closure of common land, if anyone knows about that. Hedges had been planted when the common, typically when the lands were taken over by the local gentry to keep the sheep in and the common folk out. Rioters went in and cut the hedges down, and I'm just mentioning that really because that's where the term levellers actually came from originally, in the early part of the 17th century. And James is frowning at me, I might have that wrong, but that's what I understand. So that's where the term levellers came from. I mentioned the name particularly because the levellers themselves didn't actually like the name. You know, after a year or so they had to accept it, but they didn't particularly like the name. But they went in and cut the level the hedges down. I'd always assumed that it meant a levelling down of you know, power and having a more egalitarian society. Of course, they were for that, but that's not where the name came from. Secondly, or thirdly, capital, money, was now a force in society, had been rising in prominence, if you like, as a social force for several centuries. Money made in trade, in the cities, and the global supply routes. This money was moving into the countryside and revolutionising matters in the countryside, and feeding the agricultural revolution, which was a extremely vital precursor of the industrial revolution, roughly a century later. I'm just going to make a quick mention of religion. I'm going to say very little about religion, but at the time it was crucial in understanding all the interplay between the different forces. It's this 20-year period is incredibly complicated. With people changing sides, very confusing, and it's sometimes not even clear, you know, which class the group was, where their allegiance lay. And religion was referred to almost universally by all sections in this civil war, because this was the sort of ruling set of ideas at the time, in very much the way that in modern politics, any political party has to keep referencing economics, especially neoliberal economics, which is in some ways like a sort of crypto-religious cult, I like to call it. So religion at the time was just the way people talked. They quoted the Bible and so on. So there was widespread discontent in the country by 1640. Almost all sections of society were unhappy with the king behaving. He was arrogant, he was untrustworthy, he constantly wanted money to fight a particular very unpopular war in Scotland against the Scottish, who wanted to run Scotland. His court was completely corrupt, idle, you know, socialites, surviving on all sorts of perks that the king had given them, and they were widely hated. There was some support, actually, of the king initially in that first year or two from the London merchants. For example, the East India Company had a kind of royal monopoly given to them, so they were quite happy with that, so they were sort of pro-royalty. Now, in this situation, the levellers and the diggers were, for a time, probably the most prominent of a whole range of social movements, religious, partly religious, etc., and political. But amongst this whole range of different groups and groupings, the levellers and the diggers, I think, steered away from the religious ideas more than any of the others, and they were more clearly political, and, you know, relate more closely to modern political sort of categories, which I'll refer to later. Right, so I'm going to start the talk now. The levellers, who were the levellers? Number of bullet points here. Firstly, they had widespread support, seriously widespread support, in London in particular, and in several regiments of the army, the new model army of Cromwell. They were a national organisation, formal organisation. They had offices in several London taverns. They pioneered the use of petitions and pamphlets. They sold a newspaper called The Moderate, ran briefly in 1648 to 1649. Their manifesto was called The Agreement of the People, came out in several different versions, sold and read widely between 47 and 49. They actually had sea green ribbons, which were like a badge, I suppose, which they wore on demonstrations, or for the poorer levellers, I suppose, used to have sprigs of rosemary in the hats to signify their allegiance. And they were highly significant players in these complex events of the English Civil War. Both levellers and the diggers actually were really rather short-lived. Their prominence, period of prominence, for roughly 4 years, between 1646 and 1650, in case of the levellers, before they were physically smashed by Cromwell, with brutality and trials and hangings, etc. They ceased to be major players. The point for us, I think, is that their ideas lived on for several decades, and in fact, we can see reflections of their ideas today. So, what were the levellers' demands? Another series of points. So, first of all, they were for popular sovereignty. They wanted ultimate political power to lie with the people. not with the king, with royalty, not with any parliament that was elected by only lords, for example, or the only landed gentry. Secondly, they were for the abolition of property qualifications, or consequently they were for abolition of property qualifications for voting. They wanted the vote extended to all adults. There's a little proviso I've got to be honest, I've got to put in there, and that is they wanted the vote extended to all adults, excluding women and servants. And on the face of it, that sounds quite outrageous by our gold standards. And I'm not actually going to even attempt to explain. I mean, the booklet I've got this from, mainly by Nora Carlin, has a few sentences to explain that. It doesn't really explain that. I haven't researched it fully. It wasn't, and it will become clear later, it wasn't that they didn't think women and servants should play a full part. They really did. But there was quite a slightly bizarre set of reasons why this wasn't in the demands, the original demands. I'll come back to that briefly. They wanted two-year parliaments, which of course we don't have. The first two we do more or less have, the popular sovereignty, the abolition of property. Fifthly, they wanted boundary reform, which we of course have had from the 1830s onwards. They wanted a ban on re-election, which is quite interesting. I think that'd be quite useful from our point of view, wouldn't it? So we don't have a permanent class going down to Westminster to the so-called Westminster Village, that people would just take their turn and go in there for 2 years. They wanted two-year office, and then somebody else would do it for 2 years. So I think that's a very, very socialist idea. I like that. They wanted religious tolerance for all religions, complete, total tolerance. People could be any religion they wanted. They wanted equality before the law, which we do have now, apart from the fact that if you're rich, you tend to get more equality than other people. They wanted laws to be written in the vernacular. Again, I haven't researched that. What were laws written in Latin, maybe, or French? Presumably Latin before then. I don't know. Latin. They wanted an end to imprisonment for debt, which we more or less have. And they wanted an end to corruption. Well, quite right. But I doubt whether things are corrupt now, as corrupt as they were then. So how did they organise? Well, they did things which seem very familiar to us today. They went around every ward in London they covered, knocking on doors, presumably with two people, one more experienced, one less experienced, like, dare I say, Jehovah's Witnesses or other people, canvassing to get support. It was a formalised organisation that you joined and you had to pay a subscription. And subscriptions ranged from sixpence to 2 shillings and sixpence a week in the money of that type, which a quick calculation, assuming inflation is 50, which it might be roughly since then, that's between £1 and £6 a week. So this, you know, this was serious money, I think. And now it's amounts up to serious money for a lot of people. The leaders, often the organisation was around and focused on the arrest and trial of the leaders. John Lilburn, one of the most prominent of the leaders, was arrested in 1645, put on trial and again in 1646. On both occasions, he was freed. You know, the court just abandoned its proceedings and freed him because the demonstrations were so massive. Tens and tens of thousands. Massive great petitions presented to Parliament. And they just, you know, they thought, well, for the usual reasons, we've got to back down here and release these leaders. And it was after the second of those occasions that they started being referred to as levellers, and the organisation really took off. So as one petition presented to Parliament in 1646 amounted to, or represented, a third of London's population at the time. And I'm not saying, I mean, some people maybe didn't live in London, live nearby, but it was the size of a third of London's population, which I think is a massive achievement. Later on, 2 years later, when the thing started going downhill, other leaders were arrested, tried, several were executed, others jailed. Again, massive turnouts at the funerals, but the thing was on the down. Now, I have to mention the presence of the levellers inside the army, this new model army, it was called, of Cromwell and the parliamentary forces. it was very strong, as I said before, in a number of regiments. Again, they didn't like the term leveller when this thing kicked off, and so they elected the soldiers, the revolutionary soldiers, leveller soldiers, elected agitators, as they called them. And there were so many of these and had such widespread support inside and outside the army that the top brass, the top officers, who were dubbed grandees at the time, were forced to recognise that this was happening. And and what they did was, the soldiers had several grievances, some political, some really quite personal, including the fact they hadn't been paid. So a lot were volunteers, but they, you know, they needed money to live on. So. But there's no doubt their aims were broader. Their aims were political. It wasn't just the fact they hadn't been paid. They engaged in open debate. Every time there was a meeting, anybody could speak, women and servants included. In fact, they made a particular point of saying, this is everybody. Everybody can participate in this. Any religion, any class, any section. The army was forced to respond to this situation, possibility of complete rebellion on the part of the whole of the army, and they formed a high council, as they called it, specifically to deal with the agitators' rebellion, and they set up the famous Putney debates. And the Putney debates went ahead, and everybody put their point of view, and when they'd finished, Cromwell arrested the leaders of the levellers, and as I said before, actually hung some of them and adopted, you know, brutal methods to suppress it. Yes, there were mutinies after that. Yes, it wasn't all over, you know, in a short period, but by about 1650 or so, it just wasn't a prominent force anymore. So, just to finish my levellers comment before I go on to the diggers, I think, and Nora Carding makes this point, in a sense, the levellers were a kind of evolutionary common ancestor, not just of modern communism, but also of anarchism, of communalism, of social movements in general. Quite a kind of spectrum. You know, they weren't simply our precursors, our sort of ancestors of our ideas. it was quite broad. Anarchists, I think, often claim the levellers as, you know, as theirs. So they were not quite a political party, although many, as described, many party political methods were developed by them. Okay, so I'm going to race on to the diggers, often referred to as agrarian socialists. And again, they didn't actually like, they didn't like the term diggers. They referred to themselves as the true levellers. And they really grew out of the failure, in a sense, grew out of the failure of the leveller movement. On an ideological level, in a sense, they were more radical in that they were demanding, planning, complete abolition of private property. So, probably more related to modern anarchism. One of the most prominent individuals, Gerard Winstanley, published a pamphlet with others called The True Leveller Standard Advanced. I'm just going to read a quote from this Diggers pamphlet. Not one word was spoken in the beginning that one branch of mankind should rule over another. Again, it's kind of religious. He's referring to, you know, the Christian mythology of origins. Not one word was spoken that one branch of mankind should rule over another. Jump a bit. All labourers, by their labours, have lifted up tyrants and tyranny, and by denying labour for hire, they shall pull them down again. With no one left to work for them, said the diggers, the private property of the rich would be of no use to them, and they would be forced to join the new society, in which bondage shall be removed, tears wiped away, and all people, by their righteous labours, shall be relieved and freed from poverty and straits. Yeah. And I think that beautiful poetic chimes completely with the socialist project of today. They were religiously, I was going to say, seriously egalitarian, self-sufficient. They were very ecologically advanced. They really consciously wanted to live in harmony with nature instead of just raping it, which capitalist agriculture obviously does. They had one quirk in their ideological positionings. They looked back and saw the Norman conquest as foreigners invading England and destroying a kind of a golden era of, you know, wonderful democracy and harmony, which I think is complete fiction as far as I know. And they did often, you know, hark back and describe what had been happening in England since 1066 as the work of these horrible French Norman people who'd invaded and taken over the country, which obviously we wouldn't go along with anything like that at all. Physically, they, as you probably know, they took over St George's Hill, quite a small hill south of Weybridge in Surrey, and set up, you know, a communal agrarian village. A dozen or more digger communes in at least 10 other counties sprang up in quite a small space of time. I think it has to be said that the total number of people, I haven't even tried to estimate it, but the total number of people actually involved in these digger communes was really, really tiny compared to the number of people involved with the leveller movement. But the ideas are so very, very similar. And I'm sure lots of levellers that weren't up to, you know, packing in their family business and going down and joining the commune, I think they, so, you know, there was considerable support amongst the people who supported the levellers for what the diggers were attempting. Again, just mentioning religion here, at the time, to be an atheist, an outspoken atheist, was absolutely unacceptable. I mean, nobody, you know, almost nobody actually dared to do that, to actually, you know, use this position. But when Stanley referred in the pamphlet and other pamphlets that he wrote as the great creator reason, well, that's clearly not a, you know, a Christian thing to say, that the creator isn't God, the creator is reason. And I think at the time he was regarded as a free thinker, the term used at the time. In modern terms, they were what I think would be called pantheist. They saw God as in all nature. And Nora Carlin makes the point that this is literally what we would call today materialism. Because if functionally it's the same as materialism, it's just simply adding a different word onto nature, science, the way things work. So, in effect, they were atheists, I think. even though they still used biblical quotes like everybody else at the time. So they were in favour of, with the capitalists, if you like, with the new rising capitalist class, they were in favour of more efficient use of the common land. But they wanted this to be to the benefit of everybody and not just the gentry, the new capitalist class that were actually stealing this common land. So what was the outcome? Same as the the levellers, they went up like a rocket, came down like a rocket. That's a main rocket. And again, like the diggers, they were tolerated at first. And they moved actually from when they were chucked out of St George's Hill, they moved just down the road to Cobham. And the local squire was quite friendly towards them. And then I think he kind of, you know, probably thought a bit more about it and realised this was total revolution. He became anti. He took them to court. Thugs were organised to attack these communes in the night and beat people up and burn their crops and burn their little houses that they'd erected. And again, the thing went downhill because of the, you know, the suppression, brutal suppression by the new capitalist state that was emerging. And of course, today there's very little common land left because the enclosures just continued for another century. So I've got a couple more minutes, have I? So what are the lessons for today? Well, I think they were both movements, the levellers and the diggers, were clearly ahead of their time in that the way that production was organised in those days was small workshops in towns and in, you know, elsewhere based on semi-independent family production units. Cottage industry, so-called. A large industrial, organised industrial working class was a century or more away. And those conditions, it just made it impossible to actually organise what they actually wanted. The diggers actually wanted, and talked in explicit terms, they had a grand plan for gradual, but eventually total, withdrawal of all labour. Now, I think that chimes rather nicely with our general striving, which is absolutely central to the thinking of socialists or our brand of socialists today. So I think a lot of interesting kind of parallels with today, but it, the time just wasn't right. More general lessons, I think that in any period of such severity of upheavals, there is a struggle between contending ruling classes. And in that situation, it allows ruled over classes, you know, the peasantry, peasants revolt in the 14th century, etc. You know, the majority classes that do the work have an opening to actually play a part. In fact, are needed by the contending classes as foot soldiers. And of course, that happened in the English Revolution and in other revolutions, as you know. And also another lesson which is beautifully illustrated by the English Civil War period. These periods are generally so messy and confusing, with so many factions and twists and turns, and groups and individuals change sides several times in the 1640s. It's generally the case, I would argue, that a clear analysis, a clear understanding of what's going on, can only come if you make social class prominent. If you try to explain what went on without referring to social class all the way through, you just can't get a coherent understanding where deep causes are, you know, are brought out, consequences can be examined, and so on. So I think a Marxist analysis is in this case absolutely necessary to make sense of the whole business. And I'm going to stop there, except to say, yes, the title of the other talk, so I'm going to talk this subject, is Does UK Have a Radical Tradition? Actually, no, sorry, it's UK's radical tradition. But the question, does it have a radical tradition? Well, absolutely yes. I think the English Revolution, as I say, embedded within the English Civil War, makes it clear that we do have a radical tradition.